Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy writing for the majority. Justice Samuel Alito argued, quote, Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. Its reasoning was exceptionally weak, and the decision had damaging consequences. And far from bringing about a national settlement on the abortion issue, Roe and Casey have inflamed debate and deepened division. A right to abortion is not deeply rooted in the nation's history and traditions. On the contrary, an unbroken tradition of prohibiting abortion on pain of criminal punishment persisted from the earliest days of the common law until 1973. We emphasize our decision concerns the constitutional right to abortion and no other right. Nothing in this opinion should be understood to cast doubt on precedents that do not concern abortion. The Constitution does not prohibit citizens of each state from regulating or prohibiting abortion. Roe and Casey arrogated that authority. We now overrule those decisions and return that authority to the people and their elected representatives. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Your reactions to Friday's announcement of the court's decision, per the Dobbs draft opinion leak, that Roe v. Wade is no longer the law of the land, and the law of the land when it comes to abortion will be meted out at a state, at the state level in the 50 states.
And now the concern is, you know, if women order an abortion pill through the mail, are they going to be prosecuted? If they travel across state lines, are they going to get arrested? Well, in a concurring opinion, Justice Brett Kavanaugh said states should not block people from traveling to get an abortion, citing the constitutional right to interstate travel. So but people aren't listening. People keep hearing what Clarence Thomas said in his opinion, that this, you know, it called on the court to revisit other decisions, including contraception and same-sex marriage. And that had people, including our mayor, which we're efforting right now, to lose her mind. And when she was at the Gay Pride Fest last night in Grant Park, gave Clarence Thomas an FU, similar to what she did to President Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the sort of keen legal arguments, the sort of dispassionate analysis you'll get from a former partner at Mayor Brown. It's really impressive, the legal mind of one Mayor Triple Threat. Oh, well, that's how it goes. She's an identitarian demagogue. She's left the corporate law world, and she's now just an identitarian street hustler. And so that's what you get at some, you know, gathering of fellow identitarians, right? That you get the street hustle and the incendiary rhetoric and so forth. The politics of this, obviously, something we want to get to, you know, reactions coming right from every quarter. But first, just the decision itself, because so much of this is performative outrage because of the draft opinion being leaked. By the way, are we ever going to find that leaker?
What's the status
update on that, Chief Justice Roberts?
And do you notice that the leak came out right before the first primaries were held? Two days before. And I believe timing's everything, and that was purposeful.
Well, if it was, it should be a canary in the coal mine to see how impactful this will be on the November elections, because it hasn't had much of an impact on the primaries. Obviously, it's a little bit of a different story when you have Republicans running in their lane and Democrats running in their lane for nominations. But if this is what their big play is for November, I think they're going to be sorely disappointed. I'm talking about the left. If they want to make the November election a referendum, on overturning Roe, go ahead. The attitudes Americans have toward abortion are not static, number one. And so whatever polling you're seeing right now is the media does its best to whip people, pro-aborts, into hysterics to try to cower people who think this is the right decision, or people who may think this decision was too far but still don't have the abortion on demand, all 9 months of pregnancy, taxpayer-funded attitude that the left has. For example, the response from AOC is to call for a purge of pro-lifers from her party. You think that's going to be helpful in a general?
Also, if you live in a blue area, when people say go vote, that should include primary elections too. Because the thing that a lot of people don't like to talk about is the fact that not every Democrat is pro-choice, okay? So the ones that aren't, we really need to reassess if it's appropriate for them to continue to serve in 2022.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
I understand the overwhelming percentage of Democrat socialists are pro-abortion. But for those that still, for some reason, culturally affiliate with the Democrat socialists and who do not favor their abortion on demand, all 9 months, taxpayer-funded agenda, well, you're welcome to come over to the other side. See, that's how this issue is a lot more nuanced than they'd have you believe. All these pee hats running around, I'm talking about within the Republican Party, worried about the amorphous suburban women, quote unquote, as if they're monolithic, as if there are not differences between among geography and demography, as if the way you tackle the issue doesn't inform people's opinions and their vote to the extent that this is even part of the issue matrix they're considering when they go to the polls in November. And it, I don't think it will be for a significant portion of the electorate. It's just a lot more complicated than the unhinged DC press corps and these pro-abort Democrat socialists would have you believe. But here's the thing they're trying to cover with this over the top. Over there, over the top on everything. The protests, the threats, the violence. Here's what they're trying to cover. Black Lives Matter Redux. What they're trying to cover is, unlike Black Lives Matter, but there is similarity. They've had 5 decades to make the sale. They never made the sale. They never made the sale. They knew they didn't persuade America to their pro-abortion agenda. So they had to say, the law is settled. The debate is over. The law is settled. The debate is over. The pro-lifers are religious extremists. They are marginal. They are, do not represent majority opinion. Republicans won't even go so far as to defund Planned Parenthood, much less a move in a significant way at the federal level. At the states, it's been a different story. At the federal level on abortion, they don't want to take positions on it. We've successfully cowered so many Republicans from even talking about it in the context of electoral politics because we've convinced them it's a dead bang loser. And quietly for 5 decades, people across this country, and depending on how you segment the issue, a majority of people in this country never bought in to their celebrate your abortion culture.
Was sickening.
For most people, abortion is a sad occurrence and mostly something not to be encouraged
and or that, celebrated.
And that is clearly not the position of the radical left, which is the Democrat Socialist Party.
And the mainstream media. I mean, I watch local.
Which is the Democrat Socialist Party.
Well, local and national news. Do you know that they re-termed pro-lifers? Pro-lifers, according to every cable station, every local national news, they're now the group against pro-abortion rights. The group against abortion rights, excuse me. So I never heard pro-lifers. I heard against abortion rights.
They've been saying this. They never say pro-life. They've been saying anti-abortion for 5 decades.
It's just
that they never do because they're the comm shop of the Democrat Socialists and the pro-abortion lobby, if you will, to borrow their phraseology when it comes to guns, since they like it so much. Figure I'd send it right back at them. So that's the baseline of the discussion here. They never made the sale. They had to force feed it. And by the way, that's true on other issues, too. They want to force feed, and when they get exposed, because they privately knew they never made the sale, then they come over the top to shut you up and to make you, some of you, continue to believe that your views represent an insular minority when they don't. Their views do.
Point in case, here's Mayor Lightfoot a few hours ago.
Now we know what happened with the Supreme Court yesterday. If you read Clarence Thomas' concurrence, he said, thank you, Clarence Thomas.
Well, the other judges didn't agree with Clarence Thomas because the Dodd case was not about marriage equality or contraception. It was about the fetus. So he was one of the nine Supreme Court. Well, no, they didn't talk about contraception or marriage equality in their opinions. Only Clarence Thomas did. But Clarence Thomas gave them something. Now, all weekend long, it was about, oh, don't take my marriage away. At church, it was, we can't go back. One step forward, two steps back.
At church.
Yeah, at my church. It was disgusting, and I'm church shopping now because I walked out. It was just, they were so upset about Roe v. Wade being overturned. I couldn't believe it. I'm sitting there going, are you call yourself Christians? You should be happy that it was overturned. And why are you complaining anyway? Illinois is still an abortion capital of the Midwest now. It's not going away in Illinois.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy talking, obviously, about the Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade, handed out at the Supreme Court on Friday, and the fallout over the weekend that will inform at least the next 4 months leading up to the November 8th general election. We'd be remiss if we did not reference President Trump, because his appointment of three Supreme Court justices, his nomination and their confirmation during his term in office, is what made Friday possible. And that's something that a lot of self-styled pro-lifers who were also never Trumpers, including in 2016 against Hillary Clinton, they have to reconcile with. This is Trump from 2016 in the debate with Hillary that was moderated by Chris Wallace, telling you what he was going to do.
Darren is a fear.
Do you want to see the court overturn? You just said you want to see the court protect the Second Amendment. Do you want to see the court overturn Roe v.
Well, if we put another two or perhaps three justices on, that's really what's going to be. That's will happen. And that'll happen automatically, in my opinion, because I am putting pro-life justices on the court. I will say this. It will go back to the states, and the states will then make a determination.
Well, look at there. Looky there. Look what happened.
And here's the thing about Trump, for the never-Trumpers who are now trying to suggest that he committed treason on January 6th. Folks, on January 6th. You know, once he was elected, he could have gone back on his word. He could have been that person of low character that the never-Trumpers say he is. But he didn't. He cobbled together a list with Leonard Leo from the Federalist Society when he was a candidate. He made his position clear. And when he was elected, he followed through on it, didn't he? 50 years in the making and millions of lives later, and now thinking about it prospectively, hopefully millions of lives that will be saved because President Trump was elected and because he followed through on his word. And because all those people who had qualms about Trump said, well, the Supreme Court is too important. Some other issues are too important. Ending Hillary Clinton, ending her political ambitions, too important. Stopping the left's assault on all of our institutions, too important. So we have to go with Trump. We have to join the revolt that was afoot within the Republican Party and ensure that in the general election in 2016, it spreads to enough of the rest of the country to get Trump in. And ridiculed. Sellouts. The moderates. They're so pragmatic, we're told. Moderate Republicans. They're so pragmatic. We have to be more pragmatic as conservatives. Who is pragmatic? I guess it was exposed that a lot of conservatives actually attach meaning to the positions we take and want to see the flag advance for the positions we take based on the beliefs we have. And a lot of moderates don't really care. They just want to win or lose so far as it impacts the things that are more important to them, like their social status. Isn't such an interesting case study in our electoral politics, including within Republican ranks. And so I was interested by David French's tweet on Friday. Great day for American justice. A grievous wrong has been corrected. Decades in the making through long, patient, legal, political, and cultural advocacy. But it's not, the fight is far from over. The struggle to build a culture of life continues. Oh, sure. Yes, everything he said is true. And Molly Hemingway responded.
What?
So thankful your anti-Trumpist obsession and damaged ego failed to keep the country from this moment. If you had gotten your way, this day would have never happened. You should repent for your continual slanders against those who had far more courage and wisdom. Right. And to those who say, because I got involved in this, so say, well, you know, a person of higher character could have brought us to the same place and probably won a second term. Well, it turns out that person was not available. That person was not an option in 2016. So then what do you do, David French, and you self-styled pro-life never-Trumpers? President Trump goes down as one of the great presidents in American history for a number of reasons, actually, I would argue, but particularly for his wisdom and courage to make those promises in 2016 and keep those promises when he was elected. Something we don't see happen, including, by the way, with some of the other presidents that we conservatives put on a pedestal. I mean, Ronald Reagan gave us Sandra Day O'Connor. Donald Trump didn't miss. Three swings, three out of the park, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to have some disagreements with Brett Kavanaugh, I can see. But, I mean, on the big constitutional issues, pretty good choices he made. And, again, you can say, well, it was cynical. He knew he needed to cater to conservatives in the primary and then certainly in the general to address some concerns that people had. Yeah, well, good. That's what candidates are supposed to do. That's what presidents or other elected officials are supposed to do. They're supposed to be conduits for our values and the policies consistent with those values. And Trump was. And the never Trumpers have no argument. They have no argument. Because if this was as important to you as you said it was, as you said it was, for all those years, in all those columns at National Review and elsewhere, then how can you look at the selection of those Supreme Court nominees, standing by Brett Kavanaugh in that confirmation fight, and bringing us to that moment on Friday? Inconceivable. Molly Hemingway couldn't be more right. Repent for your continual slanders against those who had far more courage and wisdom. Right. That's exactly what some of these Never Trumpers should do. Mike in Union, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Just a real quick question. Now that the courts finally got it right, that it's not a constitutional right for an abortion, what about federal funding, Dan? Can you answer the question? Is it illegal to fund something that's not a right or in the Constitution anymore?
No, it's not. Right? I mean, there's all sorts.
Is that illegal?
Thanks for the call, Mike. No, I mean, there's all sorts. I mean, look at all the transfer payments coming from the federal government or the they are not constitutional rights, but we finance them anyway. There's all sorts of things that are financed or partially financed by the federal government that don't rise to the level of constitutional rights. So, no, it's not. But I'll tell you what, for all those running around saying, what are we going to do with all these new kids that aren't killed? I mean, the arguments are just astounding to watch. I hope people are really taking this in. For example, CNN. This exchange between, one of their fungible anchors, Pamela Brown, with the Students for Life president, Kristen Hawkins, about this very matter. What are you going to do with these kids? Do we have that?
Economists are now predicting that child poverty, the rate of that is going to go up. Many of these states that are now banning abortion do not have paid family leave. They do not have the extended Medicaid for after giving, women who give birth. So if you could explain a little bit more about how you're going to fight for these disadvantaged women who wanted to get an abortion, they couldn't because of the state they live in, and their children who are growing up in poverty.
Well, we've been fighting for these women and their families for 50 years. It's a fact, the abortion industry and what we hear on campuses all the time that tells women that abortion is a simple solution to all their problems. When in fact, we believe in helping those who suffer, not eliminating somebody who may potentially suffer. And I think you help suffering, you help alleviate the suffering. You don't say, well, we're going to solve that by just prescribing abortion, because abortion doesn't end poverty. Abortion doesn't take her out of that abusive relationship that she finds herself in. That's harder work. That's walking alongside someone and seeking social justice with that person. And that's what we've been doing through the Pregnancy Center movement for nearly 50 years.
Yeah. Hey, Pam Brown, it would help us do our work to support women in crisis who are pregnant if the pro-aborts wouldn't firebomb our facilities. Can we get an amen on that?
It happened again over the weekend, two other places.
Yeah. Also, I got an idea, Pam. You worried about federal funding? Take the $500 million that the federal government provides Planned Parenthood and use it to see crisis pregnancy centers for their work of supporting women who are pregnant, bring their child to term, choose adoption if they want, keep the child, and then they provide, like Aid for Women does, with I'm affiliated in Chicago, and they provide support beyond having the child into motherhood. And do you want to hear those success stories, Pamela Brown and the rest of you pro-aborts? You want to hear the crisis pregnancy centers around America's success stories of helping to shepherd women through a moment of crisis into being successful moms with children who are well-adjusted and doing well? Or you don't want to hear those?
No, instead you heard politicians from Marie Newman to her abortion story. She wrote, gave an interview to Elle magazine, to Kim Fox. We have Kim Fox, don't you guys understand? Because she got an abortion when she was in college, and she was openly talking about it.
I wouldn't be in this seat right now if I were forced to continue with a pregnancy that I wasn't ready for. I didn't have a job. I didn't have my own housing. I didn't have access to care, not just for myself, but for a baby. And that's what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And she sat down. She's,
I'm Kim Fox. I mean, honestly, Kim Fox. John and Huntley, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Thanks for taking my call, guys. Not sure, Dan, if you had a chance to read Anthony Esselon's piece in American Greatness. It was a magnificent piece, and he really blisters Elena Kagan. But he had a paragraph in there how important it'll be to help the charities that help people who are struggling with this decision. And I want to call you out and thank you for the job that you're doing with the Aid for Women. It's really made a difference, I'm sure. And thank you very much, and God bless you guys.
Thanks, John. I'm not doing anything. They're doing it, but you're right. Supporting organizations like Aid for Women and Crisis Pregnancy Centers is something that we should do as pro-lifers, and it's something that's more important than ever. Let's use this opportunity to put a spotlight on the work they've been doing quietly for, these many decades, and provide them the support they need to expand their operations to serve more women. I mean, the idea that the left wants to have this debate, wouldn't it be, I mean, essentially what Pamela Brown is saying and the left saying, wouldn't it be better if you just killed these kids?
Right. Well, that's what Kim Fox was saying. It would have been better. I wouldn't be where I am. Like actually, we need her. She's destroying Cook County. And she went on, but because she has four daughters, she wanted to say now they don't have that same rights. All four of her daughters live in Illinois. So abortion was not abolished on Friday. It's just taken to the state. And she knows that. But they're just pushing this narrative as if every right that they've ever had is going to be taken away now. And I'm sorry, you ladies who have to travel to other states to get an abortion. What do you think we've done for the past year? Travel to free states so our kids could play sports, so we could go to church, so that we could have our conference. We had our Freedom Summit in Wisconsin to have a life, to have freedoms that we didn't have in our state. So, yeah, we had to suffer for 11 months to travel to get those freedoms back, and now they have to travel.
I'm really enjoying some of the pro-aborts protests that include calls for a sex strike. You know, here we go with Liz Estrada Redux, sex strike to stop violence. Sex strike to, I don't know, protect abortion. Let me get this straight. You're promoting abstinence to stop or to make a claim for your abortion rights. Please continue your sex strike.
I think the worst one that I saw, and Morning Answer tweeted it out. It was a pregnant woman. She was between, it looked like 7 to 8 months pregnant. And she lifted up her shirt and she wrote on her belly, "Not a life yet." Like,
I hope that goes in the photo album.
The baby album? Yeah. Hey, look what mom did right before you were born. It was sickening. And then there's you want to hear this odd, unhinged, pro-abort TikToker. She has a full-blown psychotic meltdown.
Get angry! This is atrocious! This is war on women! How f***ing dare the Supreme Court do this shit?
And she goes on and on and on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Tom, Blue Island.
Dan and Amy, great words by both of you. Dan, bringing up how Trump stood next to Kavanaugh, which if we all remember, a lot of other presidents would have probably wanted to rescind the nomination. Amy, great COVID words. These were the people that, if you remember the adage, if it saves one life, and what does this do?
It saves one
Trump's going to live rent-free in their head for years now, you guys. Have a good day at the golf course.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Terry Rogers Park.
Citizens should not be forced to pay for the sin of abortion. Women should practice birth control instead of burdening the taxpayer.
Okay, Terry. Bob, Buffalo Grove.
Good morning, Amy and Dan. Missed talking to you last week. I was away near the swamp. But here's a few talking points for discussion. Women claim the right to choose. I'm just wondering, do fetuses have rights? Here's another one. Does anyone mention the Black Holocaust genocide as a disproportionate number of black fetuses aborted? is sex education contraception taught in schools? When did abortion become the default method of contraception? And finally, or maybe not finally, but is the fake news media gaslighting the sheeple, claiming, and I'm hearing this repeatedly, a majority of Americans support abortion while failing to address the last trimester viable fetuses? Good talking to you, and I hope some of the listeners would weigh in, and you can weigh in on some of these talking points that nobody mentions.
Okay, thanks for the call, Bob. I appreciate you outlining the rest of the show for us. We'll pick this up next hour.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, as you heard on this show, once it was announced that President Trump would be coming to Adams County, Quincy area, for a rally to support Mary Miller, the congressman, in her race against fellow Congressman Rodney Davis.
And by the way, Mary Miller is joining us at 7:37 this morning.
What you heard here last week was that it was likely that President Trump would be endorsing Darren Bailey, too. I know the Trump question was asked. Trump endorsement question was asked at our debate on Thursday night, mm-hmm. AM 560 debate.
And everyone wanted it.
No. Everyone wanted it, but I told you that Bailey was going to get it, and that's what happened on Saturday night.
Darren is a fearless supporter of the Second Amendment and a tireless champion of religious liberty. He will crack down on the violent crime that is devouring our Democrat-run cities and restore the state of Illinois to greatness. Darren has my complete and total endorsement.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Does the Trump endorsement inform your vote tomorrow, if you haven't already voted?
Tomorrow.
In the governor's race, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
And Darren Bailey, the state senator, don't you know, he made a promise to President Trump.
I've made a promise to President Trump that in 2024, Illinois will roll the red carpet out for him because Illinois will be ready for President Trump.
And the place was packed, thousands of people there. Craig Wall was there from ABC7, and you know, he got pictures that he tweeted out of groups, hundreds of people that were there 8 hours early in line to see President
Trump.
Like
every Trump rally.
Right, yeah, but you know, it's been a while. So he's never, well, no, he tried to come to Chicago once during the 2016 campaign, and that didn't work out for safety reasons. So it was, you know, Illinoisans welcomed him by the thousands.
New York Times report on this, done by a reporter named Reed Epstein, who's actually from Peoria. Such an interesting story in the New York Times, because Reed Epstein is one of these self-loathing downstaters who wants to sidle up to the Manhattanites by trashing his home state and home region and community. Here's the spin that you can anticipate. A 56-year-old farmer whose Southern Illinois home is closer to Nashville than to Chicago. He wears his hair in a crew cut, speaks with a thick drawl, and does not sand down his conservative credentials, as so many past leading GOP candidates have done, to try to appeal to suburbanites in an overwhelming Democrat state.
Wow.
Well, the unfortunate thing is that I'm hearing from Republicans, and some of it is like they're upset. They're upset with him. They're upset that their candidate is not going to win tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard.
Some of it's that. Maybe they'll get over it. But I'm hearing this sort of the same characterization of Bailey from some on the right that I'm getting from the New York Times. So help me explain something, or help me understand something. Please explain it to me, I should say. Part of the Trump revolt, 2016 and 2020. You revolt against the elites in charge of all of our institutions that are melting down under their stewardship. And very much like the Chicago Press Corps and the Combine Republicans who supported and are supporting Richard Ervin, you start from the premise of the people against whom you're revolting. How does that make sense? Help me understand it. 312-642-5600, Turnkey Depro answer line.
The number's there on the wall, Dan, if you need.
I see, by the way, Jesse Sullivan's super PAC. I mean, it's a C4, but it's essentially serves the same function. Has TAC ads up on Bailey today. Okay.
Well, I mean,
good. Hey, that's
it's all fair. People, we've been watching attack ads and getting these flyers. I don't know what's true and what's not.
Doesn't bother me in the least. I'm just saying, but look, I don't want to hear it about making a claim about people's records, about putting candidates side by side. This is part of campaigning. So if you can't handle it, then you should flee the arena. So, you know, tighten up. Cinch it up and hunker down.
Yeah, I voted. I voted for the first time early in my life on Saturday. And I did not vote for Bailey. And I've fallen in love with each candidate. I've had relationships with each of them. But I just, on Thursday, I was not impressed. And I still think that he voted 14 times to raise property taxes. And if somebody wants to prove it otherwise, please help me out. So if you're at the rally, we'd love to hear from you. If you, you know, closing arguments for your candidate.
It's just...
Well,
yes, he
did. He or did he not? It's
as a school board member, he votes for the property tax levy.
Okay, well then, yeah,
right.
Didn't he? Why didn't he just say that on Thursday? As a school board member, he votes for a property tax levy.
And yeah, and this is, you know, these are new issues to the wide primary electorate in Illinois across the state. Not new issues. These issues were all litigated in his legislative races, particularly when he challenged incumbent David Rice after Rice voted for the permanent income tax increase that was advanced by Rahner and surrender Republicans and Chicago Democrats. That was the impetus for Bailey to get into electoral politics beyond school board in the first place. I remember I was there. Right. I backed him in that race that he won. And so we went back and forth on that issue then. I don't really feel the need to do it anymore. Michael on the South Side.
Dan, good morning, Amy. Thank you for taking my call. I read the New York Times article last night and my jaw hit the floor. It looked like it had been written by Richard Ervin's campaign staff.
Yeah.
It was just that bad.
This is their spin, Michael. This is Reed Epstein working in service of the feckless, moribund 30 pieces of silver Republicans in this state who just blew themselves up with $50 million politically. And so they need a cover story of what happened. And of course, it's not their fault. They did their best. They're not incompetent and they're not tone deaf. It's you know, the fault of this 56-year-old farmer whose home is closer to Nashville than it is to Chicago. Focus on him and how out of step he is, and the people who are with went with him, how out of step they are, because it's not their fault. They did their best to deal with people like me and maybe you, Michael. It sounds like maybe you're Bailey support. I don't know. They did their best to try and stop us. That's crazy, people. But they just couldn't do it, even with $50 million. Not their fault. They're not craven. They're not incompetent. They're not feckless. They're not cowards. They're not quislings. No, no. They're not tone deaf. They did their best.
But isn't Irvin irrelevant at this point? I mean, don't you think? Like, I spent the weekend calling people that I know were Irvin supporters saying, don't do it. It'd be a waste of waste vote, a throwaway vote.
Oh, you were phone banking for Sullivan this weekend?
No, I wasn't. I didn't tell them to vote for Bailey, Sullivan, or anybody, well, or Gary Rabine.
Why are you calling these
people?
Because
these are people like, why in the world would you support Irvin in the first place? Let me get inside your head. I've known such and such person for 20 years. What's going on? Mm-hmm. Like, it's over, right? You know it's over. I'm like, are you conceding that he lost? Because Ken Griffin announced he's moving.
And what was the response?
Response was every same person said the same thing. We believe that he's the only person who could beat Pritzker. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, you know, he's not a Republican. Like, Amy, don't start with me. I'm just telling you.
Well, first of all, the people who say he's the one who can beat Pritzker are just repeating their candidate's talking point.
Right.
And it's the same thing with Sullivan, by the way. They're just repeating their candidate. Oh, really? Well, explain. Oh, he's the only one who can beat Pritzker. No, tell me. What numbers do you see? What numbers has the Irvin campaign? I've said this for weeks now. What numbers has the Irvin campaign put out that suggest he's the candidate best positioned to be Pritzker of the available choice in the Republican primary? I haven't seen any. Have you? Why not? And Sullivan, whose campaign GC, general consultant, cooked up a poll that's, you know, had him in the margin of error, which is just false.
There was no Sullivan surge. I agree.
It's just false. And so what numbers have you seen that suggest he's a better matchup? It's your intuition. Fine if it's your intuition. But don't tell me that somebody is the better candidate to take on J.B. Pritzker when all you have is your woman's intuition. He's a better candidate because he's more attractive, Jesse Sullivan. He's a better candidate because he's black, Richard Irvin. You're playing the identitarian games of the left. This is how, you know, pernicious that identitarian ideology is. It seeps into your way of thinking without even you knowing it. In point of fact, I'm not going to go too deep into this, but I do have numbers because it's part of my job in my other life to know what the hell I'm talking about. I mean, it's part of my job in this life to know what the hell I'm talking about, but also in a campaign sense, since I'm involved, I do have numbers. And those people who think it's so obvious that their candidate is the best candidate to take on Pritzker, I'm sorry, the numbers just don't back you up. And by the way, then people who are ready to throw up their hands and say all is lost if Darren Bailey's the nominee because he's a 56-year-old farmer whose southern Illinois home is closer to Nashville than Chicago. He wears his hair in a crew cut, speaks with a thick drawl, does not stand down his conservative credentials. Those who want to repeat Reed Epstein's propaganda from the New York Times and just throw up their hands, you're wrong.
Well, Trump support this weekend, I do think, sealed the deal.
Well, that's I'm talking about the general. Okay. I'm talking about the general election. First of all, Trump and Biden have I'm not going to go too deep into this because it's proprietary and there's a reason I don't want some of this public at this point. You can understand, I hope. But I will tell you a couple of things. One is Trump and Biden's fave on faves, exactly the same. Both are upside down in the state, 43-56. You would expect to hear that about Trump. You might not expect it to hear that about Biden and for them to be the same.
Didn't expect that.
43 fave or approval, 56 disapprove. The exact same. Part of the environment that has the generic ballot much closer, generic ballot in a generic gubernatorial in the governor's race, are you more inclined to vote for the Democrat or Republican? you know, I mean, the based on the electoral outcomes of the last several cycles, that's about minus 14 for Republicans. Right now, margin of error. The environment is providing opportunities for Republicans that no Republican could have anticipated they would have going into this cycle, but every Republican just about has, I mean, especially statewide, every Republican has right now. Snapshot in time, could change, could get better for Republicans, could get worse, could stay probably about right there. 4 months is a relatively short period of time to change things that are happening at the macro level, which are informing people's attitudes at the state and local level. But it is not forlorn. Now, this is not to say it's going to be easy. I said from the beginning of this race, and I restate it, whoever was the nominee, even given what I just told you, has an uphill climb. They are the underdog. And this is why no candidate released numbers during the primary, despite having plenty of money. Sullivan, Bailey, and Irvin obviously had plenty of money to do general election polling to try to come up with numbers that would make the case that it's so obvious they're the best candidate. Didn't exist. So just get over it and get with it to understand how people work, how these campaigns work. So that's number one. But despite that, in the environment, what the environment provides, it is uphill. It's always been uphill because of where Illinois is in terms of the partisan affiliation, in terms of the lack of a Republican footprint because of generations of surrendering to the Democrats and destroying the party from within. So we'll see. You're going to have to run. Bailey is going to have to run a tight campaign. That's going to have to be good, very good. And it's not going to be easy because Pritzker, you know, we talk about him on this show and you think it's just so obvious that he's got all these issues and people are ready to throw him out.
They're not. And now with this Roe v. Wade overturning, they're motivating more people to don't forget to vote.
Yeah.
Because if you don't vote, abortion is going to go away in Illinois, which it's not because Illinois is still controlled by the House and Senate.
Talk to me in November. Roe v. Wade will be right back to, or Dobbs abortion will be right back down sixth or seventh on the issue matrix where it normally is.
Okay.
It informs a very small percentage of people in terms of motivating their votes. It's just not true. That's what the Planned Parenthood hysterics want you to believe. It's just not true.
Abortion's a new COVID.
It's not.
Right now. Okay.
Well, I mean, right now, because, you know, when you have all this media attention on it, everybody's talking about it, but that will dissipate. Especially as people get disabused from the propaganda they're hearing that it's going to be illegal everywhere or whatever they misunderstand. But, you know, the problem with the challenge is that Pritzker, you know, is round both politically as well as physically. He's not so acerbic and grating and offensive as a triple threat is, or even a Kim Fox. And so, you know, he sort of has this aw shucks, disarming demeanor. At least that's how a lot of people perceive him. And so, you know, it's not so easy just to say, oh, well, he doubled the state gas tax and he tried to raise the income taxes. And that's and so people are going to throw him out. This is part of the infirm thinking of establishment Republicans who think you can just repeat those things and people will say, oh, yeah, oh, I'm outraged and we're going to throw him out. And that's the path to victory. It's part of the conversation for sure. But in terms of presenting contrast, which Darren Bailey provides, and exploiting that contrast to, in terms of educating some people to move some people about who Pritzker really is based on what he's done that impacts your quality of life versus how they perceive him right now, you know, it's going to be some work. This is no walk in the park, and nobody ever said it was. But it's doable this year. So for those that are disappointed that their candidate didn't come in, I understand it. I've been there. I've been there as a consultant and as a candidate.
It's not over yet. The election's tomorrow.
It's over. So you can believe that and go ahead. I mean, you should act like you should act that way. Go
People
vote.
People still have yet to vote tomorrow.
Go vote. Go participate. Yeah, I know. But let me tell you something. It's what's going to happen is Darren Bailey is going to win, and it's not going to be close. That's what's going to happen. Act like it doesn't.
And if that happens, then I will support Darren Bailey 100%.
Right. So this is what I was getting to. Disregard what I'm saying. Go fight for the last 36 hours. Go vote. Do all those things. I'm not telling anybody. I don't.
You've done it yourself.
I never say you. I always actually rail against using prognostication to cover inaction. I'm just telling you what's going to happen. Believe me or don't believe me. Act like you don't if you're not a Bailey supporter. No problem. And act like I'm wrong if you're a Bailey supporter. Keep working through the finish line. Don't take anything for granted. But that's what's going to happen. And so then the decision will be, do I throw up my hands and just say, I thought my guy was the best chance to be Pritzker. He didn't win. And so now Darren Bailey has no chance. Well, if you believe that, you can't. I mean, you're welcome to believe that, but you're wrong. And so it's the same admonition that got you to get involved in the gubernatorial race in the first place, in addition to liking whatever candidate you supported, which is, you know, while you're here, you might as well put up a fight, particularly when you have an opportunity. And what I'm telling you, whether you want to believe it or not, is the numbers say, Dan Prof doesn't say, it's not my intuition, the numbers say there's an opportunity. Frank in Arlington Heights, here on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning. You know, Youngkin in Virginia was way behind McAuliffe, too, in November.
Yeah.
And JB has a lot of hubris, I guess you could say. He's vulnerable on his arrogance, his COVID response, other stuff just beyond the inflation and the gas prices. He's vulnerable. And if Bailey runs the right campaign and presents himself as a contrast, he definitely has a chance to win. It's going to be hard, like you said. You're going to have a good get-out-the-vote campaign. You're going to have to, you know, be able to counteract, you know, the votes in Chicago. But he's doing very well downstate in that Fabrizio Lee poll, from what I saw. So he, you know, he definitely has a chance. It's going to be a hard-fought battle, but it's possible, like you said, Dan. And other people, there's been Scott Brown wasn't going to win in Massachusetts either. He came on, and that was quick. So this stuff can change quickly.
Well, yes, thanks for the covering. You know, by the way, when I got into this race with my pack, it was already a coronation for Richard Irvin.
Oh, that's
right. I was talking to one of Mitch Daniels' guys. And by the way, we'll have Mitch Daniels on later in the program. I was talking to one of his guys. Said, so what do you think about Irvin? Can he beat Pritzker? I said to this gentleman, I said, pump the brakes. He's not going to be your nominee. He's not going to be our nominee. He's in Indiana. And he's like, what do you mean? I said, well, don't fall in love with Ken Griffin's money. That doesn't decide it. And so, you know, then things changed quickly over the next 6 weeks, didn't they? So you're right. You're absolutely right. Mike, Hanover Park.
Yeah, I'm voting for Sullivan. When I listened to all of them speak, it had nothing to do with polls or anything. I just liked his values and what he stood for life. And it's nothing even against Bailey or any of the other candidates. It's just I liked what Sullivan had to say and things that he stood up for.
Okay, thanks for the call, Mike.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The violence at the hands of pro-aborts continues. Burning pregnancy centers, vandalizing Fox News, terrorizing state legislators at in the state capitals, both in Arkansas and
Providence
and Phoenix and Arizona, as John Solomon mentioned over the weekend on Maria Bartiromo's show.
I just want to remind people, Friday night, legislators in the Arkansas Capitol were trapped by people trying to break into the Capitol, pro-abortion protesters trying to break into the Capitol, threaten the lawmakers. They had to be rescued by police. A mini insurrection in Phoenix. A lot of the media aren't talking about that, but that shows you what happens when you get red hot rhetoric like we saw from Congresswoman Maxine Waters.
Mm-hmm.
And Maxine Waters, oh yeah, she was all out. She was ready to go. It was a call to arms.
You see this turnout here? You ain't seen nothing yet. Women are going to control their bodies no matter how they try and stop us. The hell with the Supreme Court. We will defy them. Women will be in control of their bodies. And if they think black women are intimidated or afraid, they got another thought coming.
Yeah, right. No, the institution has been delegitimized. That was the message from one Pocahontas on This Week.
You know, look, I understand that Justice Kavanaugh, for example, I don't know what he said to Senator Collins. I wasn't in the room. But I do know this, that the Republicans have been very overt about trying to get people through the court who didn't have a published record on Roe, but who they knew, wink, wink, nod, nod, were going to be extremists on the issue of Roe versus Wade. And that is exactly what we have ended up with. This court has lost legitimacy. They have burned whatever legitimacy they may still have had after their gun decision, after their voting decision, after their union decision. They just took the last of it and set a torch to it with the Roe versus Wade opinion.
Mm-hmm. So it's okay for you to set a torch to crisis pregnancy centers, seems to be the posture of the Democrat socialists.
Yeah, now the Democrats want to pack the courts and, you know.
Of course they do. Following on the violence and the incendiary rhetoric, this might have been my favorite call for revolution that I saw. This was on Reddit. The radical Christians are found in rural areas.
Oh, really?
Their towns are defenseless. They have almost no cops, and their firemen are volunteers. They have to borrow cops and firemen from neighboring jurisdictions miles away in order to handle anything big. And they think they're safe out there? Forget burning cities. Cities are on our sides. It's time for rural areas to feel the heat. You show up 100 deep in every rural town in a 50-mile radius intent on revolution, you'll crash their system and make them pay. And if you think I'm kidding, I'm dead serious. This was caused by backward-ass rural conservatives operating out of a Christianized worldview. They're the ones who voted for Trump in 16, those disillusioned redneck, white trash, blue-collar types who flipped massively for the GOP. Punish them. Punish their towns. They say BLM burned the cities to the ground. I say let them see firsthand what it's like when a community is truly burned to the ground. They want a civil war. They should have been careful what they asked for and voted for. Okay.
I hope that person's on the FBI watch list.
Well,
I'm writing that.
Okay, Antifa boy. Go head out to those rural areas with your friends. And you try to affect what you just described. We'll be here to report and eulogize your efforts. Yeah, go ahead. Hilarious. Now, on the contrast from pro-lifers, like newly minted Congressman Myra Flores. This was her message on Friday. She just won that upset victory in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas.
Hallelujah. I woke up this morning praying for this, and I never thought that it would happen. This was a big win, not only for South Texas, because we are pro-life, somos pro-vida, but it's also a big win for our country. If we want to see real change in bringing crime down, we need to raise a generation to respect life in the womb. Esta victoria es para nuestra comunidad hispana. Y si tanto orgullo tenemos de nuestra gente, debemos de defender la vida.
I don't know what she said that last part, but I like the way she said it. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Clark Forsythe, Senior Counsel at Americans United for Life and author of Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe v. Wade. Clark, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan and Amy. Good to be back.
So you've been at this a long time. Congratulations on the decision on Friday that was handed down by the Supreme Court. And thank you for all your work and American United for Life's work over these past many decades.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was great to see the court finally send this issue back to the states after so many decades. And we are grateful to millions of Americans across our nation who sacrificed to see this day. But we know there's a lot of work ahead to save lives and help women balance work and family.
Well, what is the work ahead? I mean, just describe it in detail. What's your number one priority?
Well, in my opinion, the states need to effectively enforce what's on the books. And, of course, this decision sent it back to the states. And I hope the American people see in a week or two or a month that that each state can decide its own policy. I hope each state will enact the earliest possible gestational limits. We need to fight the scourge of chemical abortion. And we need really solid abortion data, public health data on abortions across the country. And that would be a good starting point.
Right. I mean, the way it seems the map is shaping up with states that have trigger laws based on overturning Roe v. Wade, that's 13 states. And then other states that have already moved in the direction of prohibiting most abortions, you know, the heartbeat laws and so forth. You basically have a 50-50 country, don't you?
Approximately. I think there's 20, you know, 20 states in the middle who are going to adopt, you know, some limits, but they may be marginal. But, you know, we've got an election in something like 127 days. And I think that Americans may be surprised at what federalism does for this issue. It may ease the passions. You hear Maxine Waters, but and all the other rage. But I think maybe activists on both sides are going to be surprised at how the passions are eased by federalism as the American people come to see that each state gets to decide what their policy is.
Yeah, I know you don't know. I shouldn't assume that you don't know what each state's policy is. But what if there's a case of incest or rape in a place like Mississippi or Texas? What are the rules?
Well, again, each state will decide. Some have exception. Well, I mean, 40 states are going to have exceptions for rape and incest. Obviously, people travel for all kinds of medical procedures, and people will travel again. In fact, you know, we're concerned about that. That's the downside of federalism. But, you know, tragically, there will continue to be abortions.
I wanted to just take a step back since you're an attorney and I mean, you wrote a book about the entirety of Roe v. Wade. Just to restate why this and in particular, what the grievous error was that the Supreme Court made in 1973.
Well, they said they had found abortion in American history and basically inserted it into the right of privacy that existed at the time. And voila, we have a right to abortion. But as Justice Alito's majority opinion showed, a right to abortion isn't based in precedent. There was no precedent before they created it in Roe, the right to abortion. And secondly, we have a long Anglo-American legal heritage protecting prenatal human beings to the greatest extent possible, given contemporary medical understanding. I mean, we have all kinds of modern medical technology that treats the unborn child in the womb. But when the common law was formed in the 16, 1700s, you know, you had very primitive medical technology. So our knowledge of prenatal human development has only increased exponentially since since those years. And, of course, ultrasound hit the American medical market a few years after Roe. I think it shocked the justices, and it's permanently changed opinion.
Well, the other thing, too, since the response from the big guy was this is going to make the U.S. an outlier among developed nations, I mean, again, just to restate, of 50 European nations surveyed in a study by the Charlotte Lozier Institute last year, 47 of the 50 European nations surveyed limit elective abortion prior to 15 weeks, as compared to places like Illinois and California, where you have abortion on demand all 9 months, taxpayer funded. So again, who's the outlier? Is it the states that are moving in the direction of life, the European nations that are described in this study, or is it places like Illinois and California?
Well, Illinois and California are going to be more radically pro-abortion than European countries, if you want to arbitrarily compare us to European countries. And maybe Arkansas and Mississippi and Alabama will be more pro-life than European countries. But the tragedy of Roe and the reason that Roe was unsettled for 50 years is that the court did not adopt a right to abortion in the first 12 weeks, say, of pregnancy. And if they had done that, you wonder if that would have been supported by public opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But the court set us on the most radical, judicially created policy in almost in the world. I mean, with Roe, we were one of only seven nations that allowed abortion for any reason after 20 weeks. And that extreme policy, which they imposed case by case over the years, was simply not acceptable to the American people. And that agitation and controversy has kept Roe unsettled and led us to Dobbs.
Yeah, I mean, that's said earlier in the show, that what they knew privately, they now have to confront publicly, which is they never made the sale to the American people, the pro-aborts.
And they simply can't admit that. I mean, their posture in the courts has always been all or nothing. You reaffirm the right to abortion for any reason at any time, or you're going to have to, or you've effectively overturned Roe. And that was their position in 1992 in the Casey case, and it was their position before the Supreme Court in the Dobbs case.
Now the charge, too, in terms of the work to be done, obviously on your side, it's the legal work, but it's not just the legal work. It's also the opportunity, it seems to me, to place a spotlight on crisis pregnancy centers and the work that's been done quietly for generations that maybe now can expand. People can say, well, we want to support this. We do want to live our values, not just for children in the womb, but to support the work that's being done by these organizations maybe I didn't know about that are supporting women through pregnancy and beyond.
That's exactly right. I mean, it's not as if that work, you know, starts today. It's been going on for 50 years. I mean, there are more than 4,000 child welfare, pregnancy care centers across the country. I mean, there are national organizations like Safe Families for Women, for Children, that try to keep families together and children out of the state foster system. You know, for when families are in need and need some temporary respite, all these organizations, I mean, billions of dollars have been invested in a social safety net. And that is we have a wonderful opportunity now to expand that. And frankly, I recognize that there will be no effective law enforcement unless there's public support for that. So we are going to have the opportunity to appeal to Americans once again to support life.
He is Clark Forsythe, senior counsel at Americans United for Life, author of Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe v. Wade. Clark, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan and Amy.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's morning answer on AM 560, The Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I love the D.C. press corps. Is there more a more self-unaware group than the D.C. press corps? The lowest self-awareness of any amalgam of people in the Western world. A June 25th story. Negotiations on restoring the 2015 Iranian nuclear deal will resume again in the coming days, according to the European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, although the prospects of reaching a deal remain far from certain. June 26th, from Reuters, the U.S. convened a secret meeting of top military officials from Israel and Arab countries in March to explore how they could coordinate against Iran's growing missile and drone capabilities. Sounds like a great partner for peace. Let's start there before we get to Russia and Ukraine with our friend, Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation and author of Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, great to be with you. It's always going to be on Chicago Morning Answer, even though all you guys do is ask questions. So I've never quite understood the whole concept, but I'm happy to go with it.
If you don't, you have answers.
You have the answer. That's why we're called The Answer.
You don't, then we will fill in. We'll fill in the gaps that you provide. Yeah.
Now I get it.
That's the question.
Can you, here's the question, and you have the answer. Reconcile this for me. Looking forward to restarting those nuclear deal talks as we're coordinating with Israel and Arab countries about how to stop Iran's growing missile and drone threat.
This administration often seems to be lackadaisical and uncoordinated, and that just seems to be the name of the game. So when you say, look, here seems to be two completely contradictory policies from the administration, don't look at me like I should be surprised. You know, on the one hand, for example, the administration says, China, you know, we got to be tough on China. We got to get serious about China. And then they want to import solar panels from China, which would make us more dependent on China. Solar panels that are made by slave labor, which we just ban importing products from China made with slave labor. So if you could unpack that one for me, I'll unpack the Middle East one for you. Look, I think part of this, is the Europeans. The Europeans have been kind of, hey, we want a deal. And I'm not surprised the Iranians have come back to the table. They did completely give us everything absolutely we wanted, then more. And when the administration said, oh, geez, we can't even do that, I imagine now the Iranians will come back and say, okay, we'll take 99.999% of what we demanded, and then we'll settle for that. And the administration will be, oh, thank you. But look, there's zero possibility that even if they got an Iran deal, that would actually make anything in the region better or do anything at all. This is the one thing that people really have to understand. There is no way an Iran deal can stop Iran from getting a bomb. They already have everything they need to do that. So it's like you're basically getting a promise from a bank robber not to rob the bank after the bank robber already has, you know, the keys to the safe and the back door is open.
Moving over to Russia-Ukraine, WaPo, Amazon Post reporting over the weekend that according to senior Western officials, Russia will soon exhaust its combat capabilities. And these unnamed senior Western officials say that the balance of power could shift back to Ukraine in the coming months. What's your assessment of the state of play there?
That's a possible, but there are two other kind of complicating factors. One is, remember, the Russians can turn up the gas or turn down the gas whenever they want. So if they're feeling stressed because they don't have enough combat power to continue on the offensive, they can switch over to the defensive for a while, regroup, and come back again. So this is not like, you know, Napoleon's drive to Moscow where he exhausts himself and then has to run all the way back to Paris. And the other thing is, there's also reporting that the Russians are are basically doing a quiet mobilization. They're not actually telling the Russian people that they're mobilizing, but they're scraping around everywhere to for more combat power to throw at the fight. So I'm not sure the Western, you know, from the conflicting reports we said what we know, I don't know what they know that makes them 1,000% accurate. But on the other hand, I will say this, and I do think that we do have pretty good evidence for this. The Russians do not have the combat power to overrun the country. And every day the Ukrainians are in the fight and we're putting more stuff in there, the likelihood that the Russians will ever muster the combat power to actually occupy Ukraine becomes smaller and smaller. And also every day they do this, they are pulling military capability and other things from other places in the country. They're undercutting their own ability to do arms exports. All the money they're making off of oil, they're funneling back into the military. So it's not a free lunch for the Russians. And I know some people want to just quit Ukraine. They say, look, the Ukrainians are going to lose. I don't think the Ukrainians are going to lose.
Well, what about this newest sanctions that President Biden announced at the G7, that they're going to ban the import of Russian gold, which they say will impact tens of billions of dollars for Russia? It's their second most valuable import, you know, besides gas.
Yeah, I think that that'll put a crunch on the Russians. And we also saw news that the Russians were defaulting. Having said that, look, I mean, I don't want to say the Russian economy is sanction-proof, because when the sanctions hit and money is dropped, you got to kind of move things around. But again, the purpose of sanctions is not to get the Russians to quit Ukraine or to cause the regime to fall or even to prevent the ability of Russia to make war. It can't do any of those things. But it does take options away from Putin. It does put strain on the government. And therefore, they're an adjunct, but they're not the solution, and they've never been. So every time the administration comes out and trumpets sanctions, remember they said the sanctions were going to deter Putin from invading to begin with, and then sanctions were going to cause him to quit the war. You know, it seems like when they run out of stuff, they just announce more, you know, sanctions. The sanctions are okay, but it's just a small piece of the puzzle. And sometimes I just wish the administration would stop, you know, flying a banner. You know, it's like every time somebody hits a, you know, ball to center field, people jump up and cheer, and it doesn't matter if anybody gets on base. Sometimes it just comes off as cheerleading.
The other thing they do is announce, you know, intermittently spread out over time, plans to provide more weapons to Ukraine. The reporting that they announce as soon as this week that U.S. has purchased an advanced medium to long range surface to air missile defense system for Ukraine. How will that impact the war being waged?
Well, certainly the more the Ukrainians can do to defend their airspace, and in particular, the more they can do to shoot down incoming rockets and missiles and artillery, that's going to strengthen them. They're also getting HIMARS, which is a high mobility rocket system, which the U.S. Manufactures, which is a very, very devastating system. But again, it's the same thing like focusing on sanctions. You announce these weapon things, and it's some kind of state of progress. It's really not. Look, we all know that neither side has the combat power to win the war. When you put this stuff in there, you are increasing Ukraine's capability to defend itself, but it's not the end of it. And so what we never got from the president, and we still don't have from the president, is an actual, what's the strategy here, dude? You know, we're going to get another supplemental request in September, apparently, but we still don't have it, and we have no context. We don't even have a national security strategy. We don't have a national military strategy. We have a national gender strategy. We've got all kinds of leftist woke plans, but we don't. And the thing about strategies is they're not just this, you know, kind of thing for, you know, people sit around a map and great. That's the yardstick by which when you see these things and they say, we're going to do this and we're going to do that, you can say, oh, well, that makes sense. That's a good use of money because I see what you're trying to do here. But since they're not telling us that, it honestly, and I'm, you know, we see this in all kinds of things. We saw in the G7, they were at another meeting, big meeting in Europe, the three-seas initiative meeting, and it all seems the same. It seems like they're just sending out the B team, and they're going through the motions, and they're making up stuff as they go along. Does it sound, look, you guys have been around, does it sound to you at all like Ronald Reagan, standing in front of the Berlin Wall and saying, "Mr. Gorbachev, take down this wall." I mean, do these guys really sound to you like they've got a plan?
No, they don't. And making it up as they go along, that sounds to me like SecDef Lloyd Austin, too. Lloyd Austin responding on another matter, the matter of Roe v. Wade being overturned on Friday, said that the Pentagon is going to refuse to recognize, essentially saying that it's going to refuse to recognize any abortion laws springing from the Dobbs decision at the state level, saying, "I'm committed to taking care of our people, ensuring the readiness and resilience of our force. The department is examining this decision closely and evaluating our policies to ensure we continue to provide seamless access to reproductive health care as permitted by federal law." Well, federal law is one thing. State laws are another. Just, when Lloyd Austin and DOD and the armed services aren't obsessing about pronoun usage, they're getting involved in this matter. By the way, he also said the DOD does not have any policy to announce for accommodating female service member stations in states that have outlawed abortion. Now, that's offensive to the Department of Defense because, of course, we know in 2022 America, men can get pregnant, and he said female service members. So he's not even following his own PC orthodoxy at DOD, and that's very upsetting to me.
Yeah, I mean, when you literally, and of course, it's not just this issue. We see it on climate change. We see it on all kinds of service member issues. When you literally have the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff spouting the political ideology of an administration, which is in itself a partisan political ideology, which doesn't reflect the three branches of government, doesn't even reflect the will of the American people, but merely reflects the political ideology of a particular political party, that is the most extreme offensive statement and actions you could possibly make. And it would be okay if maybe this was a one-off. Okay, they got their talking points in the White House on this very big issue, but it's not a one-off. They've been doing it consistently, and every day we get another story about another thing, which is just ideological indoctrination and political points from administration and neglecting the fundamental blocking and tackling of keeping the country safe and protecting the men and women in uniform. I was in the military for 25 years. We get it. New president comes in, he has different policies. We get that. But fundamentally, at the end of the day, you got to put on a rucksack and a helmet and a flak vest, and you got to go out and you might have to fight and get shot at. Mm-hmm. And it might happen tomorrow. You might think you're going to your daughter's birthday party tomorrow, and instead they call you up and they say, "No, we're going to go fight and whatever." And when men and women aren't prepared to do that well, because we neglected the obligation to make sure we have a trained and ready force, you're literally committing murder. And so this political stuff, it's not just violence to the Constitution and democracy and everything about politicizing government. But every second that you commit to a political agenda is a second that you're taking away from preparing men and women to do their job, which is protecting us. And if that isn't as close to a crime as you can get, I don't know what is.
Well said. Hey, I know you're an Army guy, but did you see Maverick yet?
I did.
And your review.
Spoiler alert. I was going to talk about the Elvis film, which I also saw.
Yeah.
But spoiler alerts aside, there's a hilarious thing in there where they're going to do, I won't tell you, there's this like super difficult mission that they've got to do, which is why they need Maverick and everything else. Right. And they said, "Oh, we can't use the F-35, which of course is the latest fighter that both the Air Force and the Navy and the Marine Corps have, right?" And they say, "Well, we can't do this." And they come up with this unbelievably laughable excuse. And the reason for that is if the mission that the F-18s fly in this thing, which is incredibly difficult and impossible, and only the best pilots in the world can do, it's kind of like the guys on Star Wars trying to take down their Death Star. If an F-35 had done that mission, the pilot would have flown in, killed everything in 5 minutes, never broken a sweat, and been back on the carrier and having lunch.
That's good. I didn't know that. That's good to know, actually. That's good insight. I wish I would have known that before. Actually, I'm glad I didn't know it before I saw it. I saw it this weekend. I'm glad
you ruined the whole film.
Did you like it?
It would have ruined it. So now you've ruined it for everybody else. Thanks a lot, Jim.
Lieutenant... Wait, I want to get your movie review on it.
You know, I thought that it was fun. It was fun.
Cheeky.
Yeah, it was like...
The flying, now, look, don't get me wrong. I mean, the flying is awesome.
Yeah, it was cool.
And Tom Cruise did a lot of that himself.
Oh, really? He's an F-18 pilot?
You guys haven't seen it? He took that guy, car karaoke guy, with him for a ride. And he passed out.
Do you guys know that the plane, the test pilot thing that he's flying to get a movie, that's a totally made-up plane? You guys know that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So apparently the Chinese didn't know that.
they thought America has that?
The Chinese were actually out, like, trying to find this plane.
I'm glad they're watching.
That goes, was it Mach 10? That's what that, right?
Yeah, right. Like, oh, my God, the Americans are remote. Like, where is it? Let's get every satellite
replicate that,
online and find this thing.
Yeah. We better be careful because they're going to recruit Maverick and like the Saudis pay him like $200 billion to come over to China and fly that. Okay, Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, thanks as always, appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. One of the issues that's a separator in the race in Illinois 15, the congressional race there between Mary Miller and Rodney Davis, again, both incumbents who essentially were drawn together in the remap, is January 6th in that Star Chamber proceeding that's ongoing. Rodney Davis voted for the stilted January 6th commission. Here is our friend Brett Baer summarizing what the commission has produced so far on his program last week. And by the way, as you know, hearing Brett Baer on the show, watching him on Fox, he's somebody who tries to play it straight down the middle.
Listen, the premise here from the chairman, Benny Thompson, and Liz Cheney is that we were on the brink of losing our democracy. If anything, I think this testimony shows not only the Arizona House Speaker, all of the state officials, these officials in DOJ who, again, were working for President Trump, stood up saying we have an oath to the Constitution. If anything, I think it proves that we were not close to that. And even though the president wanted to keep on trying to overturn the election, that there were patriots along the way who said, we can't do this. And so I'm not sure that premise sells with all the witnesses that they're putting forward.
Follow the premise. And yet this happened, as reported over the weekend. A retired Texas couple says FBI agents on June 22nd broke through the gate of their rural home, threw flashbangs, handcuffed them, trained lasers on them before searching their home for evidence connected to the Jan 6 breach of the Capitol. Laura DeWolf and Daryl Kennemer, who live on 7 acres near San Marco, Texas, told the Epoch Times they attended the Jan 6 rally at the Capitol but didn't do anything wrong. They believe they were mistakenly identified by the FBI. They were not arrested. Agents produced a search warrant saying that Kennemer, the dude, was suspected of assaulting, resisting, or impeding officers entering restricted building or grounds, but both said they went no farther than the Capitol steps on January 6th. Boy, I haven't seen the Capitol steps in a long time. Good troop. And did not harm anyone or damage anything. The allegation was false. And the FBI kept showing Kennemer, the dude, a blurry photo of a man who looked similar but wasn't him.
Oh, my goodness.
So there again, the FBI and this purge that's going on based not on the rule of law, but based so much on the politics of that Star Chamber that Rodney Davis voted for. Mary Miller over the weekend was rallying with Trump outside of Quincy, came to town specifically for the endorsement of Mary Miller, as when it was announced last week, and then layered in an endorsement of Darren Bailey for governor, as we were talking about earlier in the program. We're pleased to be joined by Congressman Mary Miller. Now, Mary, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. I want to say good morning. It's a beautiful day here on the farm today.
Oh, farm, rural areas. Yeah. Yeah.
Take me to my happy place. So how many people were at this rally? And talk to me about your discussion with President Trump before you got on stage.
Well, it was a great time at the rally. I don't know. I've heard tens of thousands of people attended. I were kind of the forgotten men and women of America, lots of farmers, veterans, parents, people who love America and who love and miss President Trump. President Trump, I think it was one of the best speeches he's ever given. I want to encourage everybody, if they didn't hear it, to look it up. And it, a lot of people that I've talked to, they're horrified by what's been happening to our country. I know you were just talking about these people being arrested. I mean, the federal government has weaponized itself against the American people. And I can't stress how important it is that people are careful who they vote for in the primaries. I'm running against a rhino, like you said, who voted for the January 6th commission. He has a horrible record. He was one of the chief architects of the red flag, gun confiscation. He supported amnesty. He's betrayed President Trump, stabbed him in the back multiple times. And, I think last week with what happened in the Senate, it just shows us how important it is that we don't elect rhinos to represent us.
Well, a couple of things. I mean, one is, just on that Texas couple, not arrested. That's the problem with the FBI raid. They go in, they raid, they don't have any basis to make an arrest, and yet they got this search warrant and potentially misidentified this couple in Texas and rousted them the way that they did. We see this happening too often, just for clarity's sake there. It's interesting. I've known Rodney for a long time, Rodney Davis, your opponent. I mean, I knew him back in the mid-90s when he ran for state rep against Jack Davis, if I'm remembering correctly. So that's many moons ago. And, it seems to me he's what we see happen a lot. We saw it happen to Kinzinger. We saw it happen to Schock to some extent, which is the DC-ification of people. And, you're a conservative from central Illinois before you get elected from office, and then you start to hang with the fancy people in D.C., and all of a sudden you're more interested in currying favor with the D.C. press corps than you are serving your constituents. We see this happen over and over again. How do you protect yourself from that not happening to you in Congress?
Well, first of all, I've always welcomed in my personal life, marriage, business, transparency and accountability. And we all need it out in D.C. I'm very grateful for organizations that keep a record of our votes. Rodney Davis is one of the 10 most liberal Republicans in Congress. He has a very liberal record. I have an A voting record with CPAC and Liberty Score. He has a F voting record. And that's one thing, knowing that we're going to give account, that they are keeping track of our record. Rodney Davis doesn't want to answer for his record. And, of course, the media is giving him cover on that. The other thing is, I've always told my children, you can tell a lot about who people are or how, what they're up to by who they hang around with. And I belong to the very conservative Freedom Caucus. Rodney Davis belongs to the most liberal caucuses. The caucuses share legislative priorities, and he's been a leader in the Main Street Partnership and Tuesday Morning Caucus. And so I think that those are two things that protect us.
And I don't want to bring this up, but I think you need to defend yourself, because this is not making local news, but national news. And this is something that was said that I believe was a mistake, but people need to hear it first.
President Trump, on behalf of all the MAGA patriots in America, I want to thank you for the historic victory for white life in the Supreme Court.
And they made a big deal, the headline, Supreme Court ruling a victory for white life. And so just what happened, and just take us through what happened, too.
Well, it's so clear. I stumbled saying right to life. It's been disgusting. Rodney Davis has run a vicious smear campaign on me. And again, he doesn't want to answer for his own record. Media gives him cover, just like, you know, this is basically what happened to President Trump, too, for 5 years. You know, they trashed President Trump. They covered up what they did. But Rodney is with the liberal press. And I ran my campaign based on the issues and on the America First agenda. And he has run a smear campaign.
And what's your closing argument for potentially future constituents? With Mary Miller as their congressperson, they get what?
Yes. Well, first of all, I fear God, and I know that I'm going to give account for how I handle this opportunity. Number two, I've been living in the real world. I've got a voting record that shows that I am courageous. For example, I'm the only Republican in Illinois to vote against sending another $40 billion to Ukraine when our own border is open and we have raging inflation here. The American people have gotten whiplash going from America First to America Last.
She is Mary Miller. She's running for re-election in a primary against another incumbent Congressman, Rodney Davis, as we were discussing. Mary, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck tomorrow. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I wouldn't bring up sending Peyton to Georgia Tech with our next guest. I don't.
Peyton, my son, co-valedictorian, his grandparents both went to Purdue. We wanted to go to Purdue, but he didn't get any merit. Three-sport athlete.
Didn't get any
played
merit.
Played the bass
you
cello.
Money.
Money from Purdue. So now we have to go to actually a school that's a little higher in mechanical engineering, and that's Georgia Tech.
What's the out-of-state for Georgia Tech?
I think it's about 60.
And how much money did you get?
I kind of don't want to disclose everything, but...
Does it bring it below the tuition at Purdue?
A little bit below, yeah.
But that does...
We have travel costs because now we got to go to Atlanta instead of driving to Purdue.
But does that include the Dan Jorn scholarship?
Yes. No.
It's below Purdue even before the additional scholarship.
Okay, fine. Yeah.
So basically what you're saying is he could have gone to Purdue for the same amount of money and been closer to West Lafayette, but you chose to snub Mitch Daniels and Purdue University and send your kid to Georgia Tech.
At least he got in, so that's good.
That's what I'm hearing.
Yes.
Well, I don't know if he'll want to talk to us after that, but we'll give it a try. Former Indiana governor and president of Purdue University, Mitch Daniels, joins us now. Mitch, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Always glad to be here. Sorry we missed out on Amy's run, but Amy, you know, it could just be wants to be a little further from mom. They don't usually tell you that.
Yeah, that's good. Exactly.
Actually, that did factor in because he wanted to get out of the Midwest.
So it's good. No, I mean, you can, Mitch, right. It's a well-placed shot across your bow by Mitch Daniels there. Yes, very good. Well, I mean, part of the thing, too, which is I know you announced your retirement from Purdue effective next year. I want to talk about that, but... I mean, again, Purdue, under your leadership, holding the line on tuition for Hoosiers for your entire reign, that's it's got to be something you're proud of.
We feel good about it. It's not just for Hoosiers. It's for everybody. You know, we had last year for the first time, we had over 1,000 young people from Illinois in our freshman class, and it's going to be close to that again this year. And so it's been held down for them, too. It's not just tuition or tuition and fees. We've lowered the cost of room and board and books so that, it costs less to go here now than it did 10 years ago.
How did you do it?
Yeah.
Well, Well, that's always the question. Yes, everybody pitching in to look for ways to control our cost is a big part of it. But another part is the cycle that set in, or the, as I say, virtuous cycle, as more and more families decided that we offered, I guess, greater value. When we surveyed students, the fact that our costs are lower and they are pretty sure they're going to stay lower was a big factor in their coming here. So we've grown, the student body has grown 30%, and that's the single biggest factor.
And how did, you know, you were one of the first university presidents to come forward and say, we are opening in the fall. And how did that turn out for you when you looked at COVID numbers and cases?
Turned out very well. Weren't sure, of course, for quite a long time how it would. We just thought it was our duty to do that, not to interrupt the education of these young people. If we could possibly find a way not to do that to them. And with everybody, you talk about a project where everybody pitched in. That was absolutely one of the, wouldn't want to repeat it. It was a great experience in that sense. I give primary credit or first credit to our students themselves, who were heroic in the way they conducted themselves, urged each other to, huge banners all over campus, protect yourself, protect others, protect Purdue, and people did.
I'm still just trying to wrap my mind around this idea that if you grow, you can achieve economies of scale and actually reduce costs. Gosh,
we don't have that in Illinois.
Some other units of government may want to take a listen, perk their ears up, and try that as well. The decision to retire at this point, and then the suggestion that maybe you're interested in another run, another political run, at least in the state of Indiana.
Well, first of all, don't use the R word around my wife. I mean, I'm stepping out of this job because I think in such circumstances, I mean, it's a matter of timing and feel, I guess. But I could have certainly enjoyed it for a stretch longer. I've still got some ideas. I think I got a little gas in the tank. But your first duty is to the entity, the business, or in this case, the institution. I've always said the final exam for a CEO is succession. Did she or he leave the place in strong shape and strong hands? I'm convinced, 100% convinced we're doing that in this case, and that's what's best for Purdue's long-term future.
Well, what do you plan on doing in retirement?
Well, I don't know. You know, I really haven't thought about it. I never do at times like this. I've been through this, through some changes of life before, from government to business, from business to government, from there to a different trek, and then over here in higher ed. So I haven't made a plan yet. I've got 6 months. We've got some big plates spinning, some big things yet to do, and I'll keep my eye on that. Somewhere late in the year, we'll give a thought to the future.
Well, I mean, I don't want to get you in trouble with your wife, but I mean, this isn't me coming up with this idea for you. This was reported in Politico and elsewhere that you were considering another run, and maybe at the statewide level. Eric Holcomb, the current governor's term limited, so that would be plausible. What? No, there's no interest in that. There's no truth to it. It's
no
a maybe. I have to talk
to
your wife.
Which state are we talking about? Sometimes I get letters from Illinois, you know.
Well, I know. I when we talked to you as governor for many years, we always asked you to please scramble your National Guard, invade, and take over, but you wouldn't do it. So, yeah. I mean, any state. I don't, you know, you can, Mitt Romney can right. move around. You can move around and run for governor of any state you want.
Well, there's apparently some people talking about it and thinking about it. I'm just not one of them. And again, my duty's right here, as we just discussed, and it'll be here for another 6 months. And but no, I mean, I would consider that sort of thing unlikely. But again, haven't turned my thoughts to it.
Do you? I mean, just thinking about your political career too, because I mean, you know, look, you're credited, I think, rightly so, with leaving Indiana a lot better than you found it, as you are leaving Purdue a lot better than you found it. And so do you think about that moment in 2012 where a lot of people, myself included, wanted you to run for president, and after much consideration, I think family considerations, you decided not to? As somebody who's been successful in a number of sectors, do you look back on that with regret, or do you look back and then said it was the right decision at the time and I'm content with it?
No regret. And I only think about it when somebody brings it up, and that happens. But no, I think it was the right call for a lot of reasons. One, it might well not have ended, might not have ended well, and one can never know that. Second, it allowed me to finish the last job very strong. I was very intent on that. We had some big things left to do. Our last 2 years were in some ways as consequential as any of the others. Mm. And that would not have happened if I'd been, you know, chasing around New Hampshire or Iowa or somewhere. And then finally it led to this experience, which has just been a tremendous one. And something that I will always be so grateful that it came along. This fantastic institution of ours here at Purdue has been a joy to work for and learn from.
Now, Mr. Mitchell, did you ride in for your graduation this year on a motorized couch?
Well, it's probably that was probably a one-time thing, Amy. It's kind of hard to top, you know.
And yes.
Not to mention, we're back indoors where Purdue commencements are supposed to be. We still here are one of the few schools our size that honors every student individually. It takes 7 ceremonies to do it, and they are indoors. So the famous couch ride was the one time we've, due to COVID, the one time that we've been in an outdoor stadium. So probably going to have to watch that on tape if you want to see it again.
Maybe something like an Evel Knievel jump over buses. You're a motorcycle guy, right?
Well, I've been known to do different things. You can check out the picture of me in the middle of the student section in my turquoise shark suit at the last football game of last fall, for instance. But
really, I'm
you got to have a little. If you can't have a little fun in whatever job you're doing, it seems to me you're cheating yourself. And usually, if you allow a little levity or fun to be in it, it's more productive for everybody.
You got a little Bill Veeck in you, which I like. You know, a little bit of smoking and ashing in your wooden leg, kind of a showmanship that
Daddy
I like.
Shark.
Mitch, before we let you go, thinking about, I want to go back to something you said too. You had 2 years left on your second term, and they were consequential. One of the things that was consequential about those last 2 years was the expansion of school choice in Indiana. And now, a decade later, we see the expansion of school choice really propelled by COVID taking hold as sort of an idea whose time has finally come, and the teachers' unions are finally back on their heels where they belong as more and more families want competitive options for their K-12 choices. So how important was what you did in Indiana, do you think, what you and Republicans did in Indiana? And your review of the landscape, could you have predicted a decade ago we would be here with school choice?
Not sure what I would have predicted, because the establishment, the forces of the status quo are just so powerful, so politically wealthy and strong that they've stalled off, in my opinion, justice for a very long time. No, it was certainly one of those things that we thought was most important to achieve. It capped off other changes. We knocked all the limits off charter schools. We have total public school choice in Indiana, too, where a student can move from one public district to another without paying tuition. And now something like a quarter of all our students are in some sort of choice mode. You know, I think that the spread of this will, through competition, will improve educational outcomes. I hope that's so. But, Dan, you know, to me, first and foremost, this has always been a social justice issue. That term gets thrown around, you know. I don't think anybody owns this term. And whatever social justice is, it has to include the opportunity for poor people or low-income people to have the same choice over this most fundamental human decision of where the young will be taught. They should have the same choice as their wealthier neighbors. And it's been shameful that we've denied it to them all this time. So to me, that's always been the first driver, and it's the first
reason. All you have to do, and I've done this so many times, is spend some time around inner city folks or others who have been helped to get their student to a place of safety and probably higher quality.
Now, just on that topic too, with what you've seen occur within schools in terms of curriculum choices, parents revolting against some of those curriculum choices. We have the Supreme Court's decision, the Dobbs case on Friday. How do you look back and reflect on the what was characterized as you suggesting within the Republican Party, we needed a truce on some of the social issues, the moral issues where there is disagreement within the party, and to focus on the fiscal more so? Is it possible to have a truce when one side is still lobbing grenades?
I don't know. Again, to me, at least, the word truce does not connote surrender. It meant just simply ceasing hostilities for a little while. The point I was trying to make was we have an overwhelming, we still do, it's worse now, an overwhelming problem. The debt we're about to dump on the next generation, history will condemn people of our generations for doing. And it was really about that, saying we ought to turn our attention to that, at least temporarily. You know, I do still think that more of a live and let live outlook is more important. And some of these issues, are probably best finally settled by the people and not in some arbitrary way. But that was a different time, and I won't prescribe what is appropriate now.
He is Mitch Daniels. He's the former governor of Indiana and the president of Purdue University, retiring 6 months from now. Are you retiring at the beginning of next year?
I'm stepping out of this job at the end of this year. Yes, exactly.
All right. Great tenure in both positions, governor as well as president of Purdue University. Mitch Daniels, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You're the best. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
All didn't know it, I'll explain it to you. You're all right-wing bigots if you're not into dudes. We get 55 emails each day before noon, reminding us all that everything's gay in June. Your new Apple Watch, your ball cap from Liz. The Walt Disney Channel's got gay shows for kids. Levi jeans makes you start hearing the banjos. Skittles make sure we're all tasting the rainbow. As queer as a $3 bill in Elton John's boots. Remember, everything's gay in June.
Dan and Amy, that's Buddy Brown with the anthem for this High Holy Month of Pride. Speaking of,
what are you going to do when it's over, Dan?
Continue on. What's the difference? I can't really tell. Maybe slightly more naked people imitating scenes from Caligula in the public square, but that's about the only distinction I can make. Speaking of everything being gay in June, Megan Rapinoe. She's a U.S. women's soccer team player.
Yeah, Dan. She's a forward. So what does that mean? She scores most of the goals.
She weighed in on the Dobbs decision over the weekend because everything soccer-related needs to take a back seat to the overturning of Roe.
I wish that we could just talk about soccer today, but obviously with the ruling on Roe v. Wade, that takes precedence over everything. It's hard to put into words how sad a day this is for me personally, for my teammates, for just all of the people out there who this is going to affect. I say this all the time, but pro-choice means that you get to choose. Pro-choice allows other people to be pro-life if that is what works for them, or that is what their beliefs are, or if that is where they're at in their life. Pro-life doesn't allow anybody to make a choice. I think this, obviously, you can understand from an individual perspective how difficult it is to live in a country where you have a constant, unrelenting, violent, I mean, tide against you, an onslaught as a woman.
Gosh, I hope she doesn't leave. She also wanted me to tell you, Amy, that your kid's volleyball team doesn't matter. But in addition to that, she set this up, her, you know, tear-filled diatribe, by concluding with the laundry list. The left's laundry list, which is always fun to listen to them explain who they are in detail.
I just can't understate how sad and how cruel this is. I think the cruelty is the point, because this is not pro-life by any means. This way of thinking or, political belief is coupled with a complete lack of motivation around gun laws. It comes with pro-death penalty. It comes with anti-health care, anti-prenatal care, anti-child care, anti-pre-K, anti-food assistance, anti-welfare, anti-education, anti-maternity leave, paternity leave.
Yeah.
This is not pro-life.
No, it's not.
Yeah, that was not.
The anti-paternity leave, that's the real indictment there, too.
They're so misinformed. And one person who said it best, she's a TikToker, and her name is Michelle Rhodes. And I think this is how a lot of people feel. Oh, not that. Hold on.
You know who the left should blame for the overturning of Roe versus Wade? Not the Supreme Court. Not Christians, not conservatives, not Republicans, not pro-lifers. The only ones they should be blaming are themselves. It is 100% their fault Roe got overturned. A lot of people, myself included at one point in time, could sympathize with the scared teenager, with the drug addict who had no business bringing a baby into this world. We could understand that we didn't like it, we didn't agree with it, but we could at least understand it. We went from safe, legal, and rare to up to the moment of birth. We gave you an inch and you took a mile. We drew the line when you decided that you should be able to murder a fully formed infant up to the moment it exits your body. You have no one to blame but yourselves.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Because keep in mind, in California and Illinois, and correct me if I'm wrong, you can perform abortions in the third trimester. And I don't know, and I'm going to ask Pritzker and Mayor Lightfoot when they have their next press conference, is it up until the day before they give birth? Like, what is going to be legal here in Illinois?
So here's where people are at to that woman's point that you just played. This is from a survey done by Trafalgar Group last month, national survey, likely voters. Under which circumstances should abortion be legal? Illegal except in the case of life of the mother, 14% of the country. Illegal except in the case of rape, incest, or life of the mother, 24%. So there's 38. 38% should be illegal in all cases except rape, incest, life of the mother. Legal in the first trimester until a fetal heartbeat can be detected. All these heartbeat laws in states that preceded the Dobbs case and the decision. 20%. So now you're at 58% who believe abortion should only be legal up until a fetal heartbeat. Legal in the first and second trimester only, which is the law in the Netherlands. Okay? 31%. So now you're at 88% that believes abortion should be illegal after the second trimester, as opposed to the position of the Democrat Socialist Party, which is all 9 months on demand, any reason, taxpayer funded. And the legal up until moment of birth, including partial birth, that's 12% of the country. So there's your 100%. 38% illegal in all cases except rape, incest, life of the mother. That's essentially the GOP position. That's essentially the Hyde Amendment position. And that's the plurality of Americans. You go to from plurality to supermajority when you include legal until fetal heartbeat. So that's where the country's at. As I said before, they never closed the sale. Abortion is not something to be celebrated as the left celebrates it. It's not something to be to extol. It's not something to be encouraged. It's a sad occurrence that's mostly to be discouraged.
But yet they persist. And understand that this whole issue was triggered by liberals who couldn't leave well enough alone because Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, it's a liberal group, they wanted to perform abortions up to 24 weeks, and Mississippi law was up until 15 weeks.
So here's what you have to understand the left is. We've talked about this in so many issues. The left is a religious cult. For all their talk, Sarah Feigenholz, state senator, tweeting out or posting this picture on Facebook, this caricature of a Catholic clergyman holding a gun to the back of the head of the Statue of Liberty.
And you tweeted it out, and here it is, if you can see at home. I mean, it's disgusting.
Yeah, but abortion is a sacrament to them. Politics is their religion. They are their own gods. Abortion is a sacrament. It's the greatest expression of solipsism, which is their governing philosophy. It's their Nicene Creed. You know, only what's in my own head exists. And this was taken away from them. And this is the first time in 50 years that they've lost a religious, quote unquote, battle. And I don't mean that in the sense that this is all about, you know, Christianity versus paganism. I mean that their political ideology is religious in nature. That's how they treat it.
Yeah, they pray to false gods, which is themselves.
Things are to be accepted sans any evidence to the contrary to be ignored. And what this does is expose their religion as weak. They have run roughshod over our culture for the last 60 years. They have demanded that the laws be settled and the debates be over in their favor. And now one of their idols has been struck down. And it makes them vulnerable. And they know it. That's how you have to view this. This is not some sort of, it's not even a short-term partisan issue for the midterms. It's not packing the Supreme Court. All this other stuff is tactics and veneers that are erected to hide your eyes from the fact that these are religious fanatics. Sarah Feigenholz's Facebook profile photo is to project onto you or onto Catholics, you know, half of whom are not pro-life, what she is, which is a religious fanatic. It's so important to understand that because it informs everything you see and thus need to understand about how the left operates. Ryan in New Lenox, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan and Amy, thanks for taking my call. Listen, I just woke up from living under a rock this weekend, and, you know, I'm a good person. I believe everything that my political and media betters tell me to believe.
Right.
Did you know that if a woman has an ectopic pregnancy, that now, because of Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito, that the doctors just look down at the woman and let her bleed out, and they get in her face and they say, Uncle Clarence told me to do it? Isn't that crazy? I can't believe the time that we're living in. This is just absurd. Thanks. In all seriousness, though, it's a great day to be an American.
Thanks for the call, Ryan. Will Skokie.
Good morning. I don't know if you caught it over the weekend, but there was an opinion article in The Nation magazine, which by a feminist, who stated, yeah, we kill babies. It's okay to kill things legally. Okay, yeah, we don't have to apologize for wanting to kill babies. They actually admit it, and they say it out loud. The thing that you have to remember is the only question that should ever be brought up to the Supreme Court about abortion is whether or not a baby in utero is a legal person. And I dare them to take that one to the Supreme Court. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Will.
I mean, Mayor Lightfoot has one of the greatest gifts in her life because a woman chose not to abort her baby.
I go back to the research of Steve Jacobs over at University of Chicago, PhD over at Illinois Right to Life, that Quillette PC did a couple years ago, where as a research project, he surveyed more than 5,000 biologists in the academy the world over. 94%, when does life begin was the question. 94% of biologists, most of whom are left, because he also had them self-identify in the political spectrum, like three quarters are left of center. 94% life begins at conception. So, yeah, you want to have the scientific discussion? Happy to. Elliot Wilmette.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. There's a Democratic rep, Pramila Jayapal, in Washington, and her reaction sounded like a sentence from a Mark Levin book. She says, I am furious that right-wing extremists and Republican senators have warped the Supreme Court into a partisan political body that does not respect decades of precedent or the fundamental freedoms of millions of Americans. This because the left wants to have abortion legal up until eighth grade graduation.
Right.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call. Well, right. I mean, they're whining about AOC's talking about impeachment for lying before Congress in their confirmation hearings. I mean, it's so silly. These are people who say openly that we have a litmus test that the justice has to be pro-abortion, in addition to sometimes litmus tests that the justice has to be black, the justice has to be a woman. And they're aghast that there's politicization on the court. I mean, ever since the Bork hearing, the court has been hyper-politicized, and you can track that as a watershed moment. And both sides have participated in it, but it would be illegitimate for either side to claim that politics and these issues that should never have been settled by the court the way they were, like Roe, inform the discussions and confirmation hearings, because they inform the cases that are bubbling up for the court to contemplate. And so that's what happens. Of course, there is a political element to this. Oh, you know, gambling in the casino sort of routine from Elizabeth Warren. Pretty silly. Kevin in Austin.
Couple things. Since you're talking about that, I'll get to my original point. First was, I loved the eloquent response to Clarence Thomas by Mayor Lightfoot over the weekend.
Yes.
Where she very eloquently stated, F Clarence Thomas.
You stay classy there.
Stay classy. The other thing I want to say is, I'm excited about everybody who's gotten involved because they listen to your show, because they're motivated by that. And for everybody who's going to be working hard on phone banks, who are going to be walking to help get good conservatives elected all across the state, I think it's a great opportunity that Illinois hasn't had for a long time. So just a shout out to all those people who are going to be working hard today, tonight, on phone banks, and tomorrow, walking precincts.
Thanks, Kevin.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.